name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you guys for having me be out here and stuff like that. And it's good to be in this conference. And I want to thank the committee for all their hard work in putting this thing together. And I want to wish them all the luck in the world. And I want to thank Louie and the boys for having me come out here. And I'll try to do a good job, or otherwise I'll find a horse's head in my bed or something, you know. You ready to go to the meeting? So, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad Don finally picked me up at the airport and all that. My wife, Don, I met Don a couple years ago, and the last time I met him, he took me to Dr. Bob's house and all that, and what a great host he was, and a gracious man. And when I went to Dr. Bob's house, me and my wife went upstairs, and we did the third step prayer and went into the other room, and then I proceeded to stop up the toilet. And some type of amends. I want to go back there today and kind of clear that all up, you know, and make sure everything's right, you know. But the last time I was here, Don told me about this hideous nightmare he used to have. And this nightmare that he used to have was Don had this fear that he would die and go to hell, which could be the truth. I'm not sure here, you know. But he said that his biggest fear is he'd get down there and he'd start wandering around, and Satan would come up to him. And he said Satan came up to him and he said, you know, how you doing? And Don says, well, geez, I'm in hell. And Satan says, well, Jesus, Don, did you ever drink before? And Don goes, yeah. And he says, well, you're going to love Mondays down here. We got whiskey, we got bourbon, we got vodka, we got gin. You don't have to worry about getting cirrhosis. Hell, you're dead, Don. He says, yeah. He says, did you ever do any dope? And Don goes, uh-uh. And he says, well, that's the kind of lion that got you down here, you know. He says, well, down here, we've got it all. We've got heroin, we've got hash, we've got crack, we've got acid. You don't have to worry about overdosing. Hell, you're dead. He goes, yeah. He says, do you like to gamble? Don goes, yeah. And he says, well, you're going to love Wednesdays down here. We've got poker, we've got pan, we've got the ponies. You don't have to worry about going broke. Hell, you're dead. He says, do you like to smoke? And Don goes, yep. And he says, well, you're going to love Thursdays down here. We've got Camels, we've got Vice, we've got Cuban cigars, we got pipe tobacco from all over the world. You don't have to worry about getting cancer. Hell, you're dead, Don. He says, are you gay? And Don goes, no. And he says, well, you're going to hate Fridays. You know? So, are you a mummer? That could be hell. I don't know. I tell you, it's weird. I'm glad I'm out of the airport. I got to the airport and I forgot my license expired. And so the day before, I renewed it and everything, and they give you a slip of paper. And so I'm going through L.A. and and I'm getting checked out, and they pull me aside. And I said, oh man, not now. My case is different, you know. I got to get to, you know. And they wanted to talk to me. And this Middle Eastern guy was checking me out, you know. I need to talk to you. Okay. And he pulls me aside. Now, you know, when you get to be over 50, you know you're going to be peeing or crying every 15 minutes, you know what I mean? And on my last doctor's check, they wanted me to be a regular guy from now on. So they started giving me they wanted me to start taking Metamucil. Well, I'm not used to toting this stuff around, you know. I mean, it comes in a big jar. And I don't want to tote that around. Somebody will think you have a problem. You know what I mean? So I put it in a little baggie. What do you do with it? You know what I mean? So I put it in a little baggie, and I, you know, you got to have, so I had a little tablespoon in there, you know, and it's all laying in there. Sure enough, they run my briefcase through, and this Middle Eastern guy, look, Letty, come here, Mr. Thomas, I need to talk to you. I go, Jesus, what is it now, you know? And he talked to me about my license, and he pulled me over to the side room, and he goes, opens up, he goes, what is this? And I said, oh, I says, that's Metamucil. What is Metamucil? And I said, oh. I says, Metamucil kind of helps you be regular. What is irregular with you? And, you know, I said, Well, it's an allergy of the body with an obsession, you know. And I said, well, I says, it kind of helps you go poo-poo. Poo-poo? You know poo-poo? I says, I poo-poo. He says, I poo-poo good now. He says, why you know poo-poo? I says, I can poo-poo all right, you know. I poo-poo. He's telling me how good he poo-poos. And I said, I'm happy for that. I poo-poo now, too, you know. And so he grabbed one of his sidekicks, and he came over and explained to him, you know. And I thought, you know, all the years I used to go back and forth to Mexico, never got stopped. Here I got to go talk with you guys, and I'm going to get hauled in for three fingers of Metamucil Brown, you know what I mean? It's just... So anyway, I'm glad my wife took off for the weekend, you know, and it's weird. She took off, and the first thought I have is, you know, when the wife is gone for the weekend, the first thought I have, and most of you men know what I'm talking about, was, now I can vacuum the way I want to. Where the hell did that come from, you know what I mean? But she's a good lady, beautiful. I love my wife. She's at a woman's retreat this weekend, and I'm glad I'm here. Some guy asked me out there, he says, how come you don't have any workshop tapes? And I says, well, I says, you know, I mean, who wants to hear about making coffee? I mean, because that's what I am. I'm just a coffee maker. I'm just a regular guy in AA. I don't got any magic wands here. I find the peace and serenity in my life in my rut. I live in my rut in AA. And my rut is Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I'm in meetings of alcohol. See, I have a home group. My sobriety date is May 2nd, 1982. Our first little thing here, our first, what is it, the, what do they call the theme of the conference? The first year, the road gets narrow. I think the second year it says should say the road gets less crowded. I find my peace in my rut. I live in my rut. I look forward to my Monday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. Things that I used to hate to do, I find that that's where I find my peace and serenity. Doing those things that I don't want to do. Doing the uncomfortable to get comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I want to welcome you. And I want to let you know that you need to be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life. You know what I mean? AA isn't about doing the comfortable. It isn't about doing the convenient. It's about doing these hideous things that you know won't work for you, and eventually they become routine. And in between these meetings that you go to, we know you're going to get goofy. We know you're going to get restless. We know you're going to get irritable. But thank God you know that on Monday night you're going to float into a home group. Thank God on Wednesday night you're going to float into a home group where people know you, and you get to float in with some other people that have been restless and irritable and discontented, and you come and you sit, and after the chapters are read and after the traditions are read, we all feel that sigh of relief here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that isn't you glad you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and feeling that way, rather than locked up in your little room fighting that ongoing battle between you and you and your mind. You never win that battle. My mind's always had power over me. My mind's always told me what to do, you know. I've got the type of head that don't care I'm in AA. I've got the type of head that don't want the obsession removed. I've got the type of head that could care less how good I'm doing and that I'm talking in Cleveland. I've got the type of head that no matter how tired I am, around 3 o'clock in the morning, it's going to, hey, Larry, let's chat. Now, I know you're tired, but I want to talk to you, you know. I want to talk to you about when you were a kid and bring you right up to date. You know what I mean? And the only frustrating thing about that is we just did it the night before. You know what I mean? It is relentless, you know. But when I do these things in Alcoholics Anonymous, it brings about something that an alcoholic could never find unless he had two fingers of bourbon. And after a while, that left him, is that little peace of mind, where the head and the gut finally come together and you're all right. You see? That's why I love my meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I love my routine and having my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to have my hooks in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to be getting my hands dirty in my home group because this podium has killed more people probably than it's helped. You see? In my home group is where I live and where I survive. You see, that's my Akron. When I think of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think of Cleveland or Akron or Dr. Bob's house. When I think of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think of my home group and the people in it and what I can do there. You see, because that's the atmosphere that was created for me. And it is amazing how it, over the years and years, how it trickled down from a little kitchen table in Akron, where we all have this thing called a home group. And it's my responsibility to recreate that atmosphere. I'm a proud member of my home group, and I hope I never get any bigger. I hope my ego never gets any bigger than my meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I need a commitment. That's why I need to be in meetings where there's guys 30 and 40 years sober who don't care how wonderful I think I am. They just want their damn coffee made, goof. You know what I mean? My sponsor's one of them. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 24 years and not amount to a damn thing, you know? Yeah. He created the hard, hard school of sponsors, man. I remember our first meeting. I got in that car, and my sponsor says, "Jesus, you're an intense little son of a gun," you know? And I says, "Well, I'm kind of a private guy." And he goes, "Oh, you're a sneak." Really? He says, "What kind of work you do?" And I says, "Well, I've always been a jack of all trades." And he says, "Oh, you can't hold a job." He says, "Are you married? You got a girlfriend? Or are you a mummer?" And I says, "Well, I've always been a free spirit." And he says, "Oh, you're a cheater." I says, "Take me back to the mission, you know, my God, you know." But he read my mail. Thank God for identification and Alcoholics Anonymous, the lost art of an AA meeting, where everybody has to come and see how different they are and throw you all these things that they are other than being, "I'm an alcoholic and a plumber." You know what I mean? We're going to talk shit today, you know what I mean? I'm an alcoholic. It's a spirit of identification. And thank God we have that, so that when you tell people these secrets that have been hounding you for years, and the longer you hang on to these secrets, the worse they are. Thank God that when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and I took that fifth step, my sponsor wasn't shocked. Can you imagine if you shocked your sponsor in your fifth step? You go, "Huh? What? Jesus Christ, get out of this car," you know? Get, you shouldn't even have any pets, for Christ's sake, you know? Get out of here, guy like you running around like that. And the amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that after that fifth step, you look at your sponsor and you say, "Get out of my car, sponsor," you know? You shouldn't even work at Petco, you know? Identification, man. The soothing grace and the soothing voice of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we take our problems to our sponsors, we bring our solutions to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to give these guys some kind of hope so it doesn't sound like the Oprah show, you know what I mean, where these guys can hear about the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's all I got. I don't need to dress that thing up anymore. All I need to do is, and you know what, and that's why I come to meetings. I don't come to meetings to hear something new and different and classy. I come to meetings to make sure I'm on the right track. I got this gravitational pull in my mind that it's always taken me out of the center of alcohol. There's something about the alcoholic. It's always taken him out of the center. It's his mind. It's his that. He's got something about him. It's always taken him out of the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's, thank God, for a sponsor who is doing the same thing he's telling you to do. So his main job is to, boom, get back in the center, kid. Get back. I know what it seems to you. I know it's a nice Mercedes. Get back in the center. And they're constantly bumping you in the center because it's the nature of the alcoholic to always wander off, always do this. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, then one of the amazing things that happens once you've been here a while is you get to see people come to AA and they get their little jobs back and they get a little apartment back and they get a little somebody to dance with tonight. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And normal living is not the treatment for alcoholism. That just comes from hard work and good fortune. The treatment for alcoholism is that eye-to-eye contact with that new man, coming to this meeting, giving back a little, finding out who you are, what you are, and what you're supposed to do, staying in and giving this thing away. That's the treatment for alcoholism, is Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happens is these people come and they get these things, maybe when they're new, maybe when they're older, and they begin to think that because they have these things, that things are going good. Aren't I working a great program? Things are going well in AA. And they wonder why they're sitting in meetings and they're restless and they're irritable and they're discontented. And they look around and they have every material possession. They got everything. Every instinct is satisfied, but yet they're sucking on the end of a gun, and they're wondering what's wrong, and they become sitting ducks for medication. They become sitting ducks for finding other answers, when all they needed to do was go on a little panel, sit with a sponsor, get a new guy, and start sharing this message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how unimportant those important things become, and how necessary it is for us to keep a primary purpose.
That's why I need a singleness of purpose. That's why I need a primary purpose, because everything in me tells me the answer is something else. And I come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you reassure me that I'm on the right track. And there's nothing more secure than knowing that you're at the right place doing the right thing. Every alkie loves that. And if you're new, you're going to have a tendency to want your sponsor's approval. I know you are. It's a basic ingredient when you're new. And there's nothing worse than you can do. Because what happens when you're a people pleaser like me is that when you become wanting your sponsor's approval, you begin to hold back things because you want him to give you the nod. And that's the worst thing that an alkie can do, is start having secrets with his sponsor. He knows you're a goof. You don't need to impress him, you know. He knows you're whacked out, you know. You just need to continue to be honest. And that's why I love my sponsor. He doesn't buy none of my nonsense, man. And he keeps bumping me in the right track, you know. And I have a great family. I was born in Detroit. I come out to California when I was about 4 years old. I brought up in a little foster home, and my folks split up for a little bit. And my mom was a little Scandinavian lady. My mom loved diet pills. My mom was always running around the house around 4 o'clock in the morning, sorting out nuts and bolts all night, you know, or raking the neighbor's yard around 5 in the morning, you know. Just a busy lady, you know. She had a hobby. Her favorite hobby was to make afghans. Everything in the house had a fresh afghan. The chairs had afghans. Couches had afghans, you know. Any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. She'd get her prescription filled, and she'd do the whole block with the power edger, you know, just a busy lady, you know. And she had hobbies. She liked to take that speed. Her favorite hobby was to do jigsaw puzzles, you know, and these 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert. She didn't want to be bothered with color, man. She just wanted to put those things together, you know. And she'd go to Savon's, get her carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had the coupons on the back, and she saved these coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in. She'd come home, put her one and only muumuu on her entire life, and start taking a couple more Dexies and putting together this puzzle. And she had a big pair of toenail clippers, because if she had a piece that didn't fit, well, she's going to snip that little piece down until it did, you know. She had a job to do, you know. And I tell you, I found out at an early age that my mom loved me. I found out at an early age that my mom loved me. And I was to do with that lady what I would do with anybody that ever showed me any ounce of affection or attention, and I would play her like a fiddle. Up until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there would never be a chance that I would pass up to use that lady. Never once. I don't ever want to forget what it feels like to be out of that family for a while and coming out of an institution and see my mom working at that dry cleaner's, and I'm about from here to that wall, and she hadn't seen me for a little while, and I'm in my street mud, and I lock eyes with her, and the only thought that I have is she better have a dollar. To walk up to her, to make eye contact, to see her trembling and afraid, to go through her little purse seeking out those $1 bills, and to see a little picture of me when I was an 8-year-old boy. And that's the only picture she had, because anything after that went downhill, you see. And the selfishness and self-centeredness that I carry with me today, if my alcoholism don't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. I don't ever want to forget that. Because the kind of selfishness guy that come to you in Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you put a secretary of a meeting that same distance between me and my mom, how come it's easier to walk to my mom and use her? How come I can't walk to that secretary that same distance and ask him for a commitment in a meeting? See, that's the kind of selfishness that had to be removed. That's the kind of actions that it took for me to stay here, you see. And my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He was a World War II vet. My dad was a refinery worker, so my dad was always coming home at different hours. My dad was a type of drunk that was always sneaking into his own home, you know, and he's always climbing through my bedroom window, you know. And I could feel it, because he'd had that big boot coming through that window, you know. And he stepped on me one night, and I grabbed it. I said, hey, I said, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know. Hell, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, you know, my God, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. And but man, my dad made drinking look good, you know. He made being a man look good. He was the type of guy that everything he touched turned to gold. He was the type of guy that hung in. He started something and he finished it, you know. He had some type of character about him, you know. He's the type of guy that started off at a refinery as a maintenance man. And 35 years later in Torrance, he's the plant manager, head of OSHA of the same refinery. See, he knew how to hang in and work through things. He knows how to weather the storm. I don't weather the storm. I'm the type of selfish, self-centered, self-pitying little kid that all my life I've been doing average things expecting standing ovations. Yeah, I'm the type of guy who goes to work, works 8 hours, and I think the boss is up in the office going, Jesus Christ, man, they just don't make them like that anymore. My God, that kid put in 8 hours of work, man. And he only took a half-hour lunch. They just don't make them like that anymore, you know. And I'm like that today, man. I put a toilet seat on for my wife a couple months ago. And me and her would come home from the meetings, and I'd go to my room, and she'd be in the bathroom, and I'd be sitting on the bed going, come on, Rosie. My God, man, look around yourself, woman. You know? That's a brand new piece of maple wood you're sitting on in there, you know? What do you think, God put that on for you, you know? It wasn't God, it was Lawrence of Torrance that put that damn thing on, man, you know? I couldn't stand it. I finally had to tell her one night, you know. She said, oh, I know, you know, but I'm like that, you know. Always got to have the nod of approval because I've got lazy rear all through me. I've got this laziness in me that just can't stand to earn things. I've got this laziness in me that thinks I deserve things without earning them. I've got my hand out all the time, and if my hand's not out, I've got my pity card. Always playing on people. Always playing on people's emotions. Never doing nothing, earning my own keep for nothing. Always think I deserve it coming to me. And that was the same attitude that come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming in these rooms, sitting, waiting for the gift. Where's mine? A something for nothing guy. Give me that half pint, I'll pay you later. Give me that bag, I'll pay you later. Give me that serenity, I'll do those things later. Never wanting to earn anything. Never knowing what it's like to weather the storm and do the actions. And the amazing thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is if you sit in here and you don't put any effort into it, when it comes time and life hands you a big lump, there ain't nothing going to keep you from going out. What's the use? I ain't got nothing hooking me here. I can come back later. I've seen people doing it with impunity. But when you start putting a little effort into this thing, you start thinking twice about stuff like that. And you know what, man? I got something here. I've got some effort put in this thing. And it becomes a little harder to throw away because you've put in some sweat and toil in this thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, you see. I never put sweat and toil in anything, man. My dad's a happy drunk, like I said, and I wanted to be like my dad, but I knew I wasn't like that. And some nights I would hear my mom and dad talking, and the walls were thin, and we had a small house, you know. And I could hear them saying, where did we go wrong? What could we do better? And never once did I go in there and pound on that door and say, hey, you folks got it all wrong. It's not your fault. See, that was my green light through life, is to play those folks. Because I always knew that I could run on their emotions. And around 11 years old, sobriety stopped working. Me and these four guys are in a garage, and we start passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, man, I felt normal. And that was going to be my dream up until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't to be an engineer or a chemist or a doctor. It was that one of these days I'm going to think and feel and be normal because I knew there was something about me. I'd compare myself to everybody in that neighborhood and I'd see that everybody was grasping and developing a manner of living. And I seemed to be restless and irritable. I seemed to have this fear about me. I always seemed to have this lack of confidence and have these dreams about doing things and talking myself out of them immediately afterwards and never doing nothing in my life. A constant hamster in a cage, never going nowhere. Constantly thinking of what I'm going to do and yet constantly talking myself out. Never going nowhere. And knowing that that's going to be my lot in life. Because if it ain't given to me through the clouds, I don't know how to get it. I don't know how to have goals. And I don't know how to have dreams. But at 11 years old, I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey and my dreams was answered. For a half hour, it turned Howdy Doody into James Dean. And I loved every minute of it. Now, I didn't go out and, you know, to Skid Row the next day. But I got the address, you know. And it wasn't hard to find, and I'd always be nursing that stuff, and I'd always be taking it to school. And I remember being a freshman in high school, and I started drinking and started hanging around these Mexicans. I started dating this little Mexican girl. Her name was Lupi. She had some brothers. I started hanging around her brothers. Her brothers had Chevrolets, and over there in California, we like to lower our Chevrolets down, and we like to get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know. We'd drive around. We'd listen to the Temptations and the Four Tops and Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck a couple months ago, and the Four Tops came on. I just start stinking in my damn truck, man. I loved it. I had a Mexican girl named Lupi. She curled up her hair real big. I get my hair up real big. I had these white T-shirts with these back khaki pants. I put my little 38 down there. We'd bounce around with these big frowns and wondering what the hell you're staring at. What are you looking at, you know? And we're frowning because our ass hurts from bouncing around all night, you know? And we'd drive around, man, and drink that Thunderbird wine, and know everything was all right, man. I ran into a kid like that not too long ago, man. I was over at the Glendale Mall. This kid comes walking by me. He's got a bald head. He's all tatted down. He's got a tank top on. He's got these big pants you could put about five guys in. He's got three beepers because he's an important kid, you know. And he's got his mom's earrings on. He's got a ring in his nose. He's got a dot in his nose. He's got a ring to his lip. He's got a chain to his wallet. He's got a ball bearing in his tongue. I walk by him and he goes, "What are you looking at?" I said, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know." A couple months later, I started sponsoring the kid. Down there in San Diego, give me those calls. "Hey, sponsor. What do you want me to do?" And I says, "Well, Jesus, Jason, why don't you unlock yourself for Christ's sakes, you know?" "Yeah, well, I'm going to these meetings, man, and I feel so different." And I says, "No kidding. Maybe it's because you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, you know? But I understand that, man. I'd bounce around with these guys and I found an image. I found a way of life, man. And I knew that me and Pooch and Loopy were going to bounce off into the sunset, man. And, you know, and I love that, man. I remember the first time I was in the... I remember the first time we were in driver's education. It seems like they always have a big football coach driving you around. And I'm getting kicked out of all these schools, so I got to take summer school. So it's a night, hot summer day, and I got this coach. He says, "All right, Thomas, get into the car." So I get my hair into the car, you know, and these four girls are in the back seat. They want to learn how to drive. And he says, "Go over here and parallel park." So we parallel park, you know, and he says, "Well, you guys seem to think you're doing all right." He says, "Why don't you go up to Torrance Boulevard and go to the Jack in the Box, and I'll buy everybody some Pepsi." So I drive up to the Jack in the Box, and I totally forgot that, you know, 15 minutes before class, somebody gave me some barbiturates. And I'd been a good kid. I'd just been drinking wine, minding my own business. And I took four of these things, and Jesus, man, it knocked me out. All of a sudden, there's four coaches there, you know, and I can't talk or see. And he goes, "Drive up and talk to the puppet, for Christ's sake." "Well, I can't see the puppet, you know. I can hear the puppet, you know. Can I have your order, please, you know?" And I drive up, and I crash. This puppet's head's hanging down. I run over the damn puppet, man, you know. The cops come. They throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair all over the car. And I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal, man. Now I can drive shotgun all night, man. Let Rudy drive all night, you know. And I'm driving around, and I make that magnificent discovery that every alky makes, is that you are one of the finest-looking men have ever made, man. Look at you, man. And every drink I drank, my eyes got bluer, my hair got bigger, man. I'd look at myself in that mirror and go, "Jesus Christ, are you good-looking? My God, you ought to be an underwear model guy, you know? You know, you don't even wear any, but what the heck, you know?" And I'd drink that Thunderbird wine, man, and I'd see all those cigarette butts stuck in my hair, you know, and see that big chunk of vomit on my tank top, you know? And I said, "My God, I feel like dancing when I look like that, you know? Oh, yeah, man, I drink that cheap wine. I look at myself in that mirror, and, man, are you going to get them, killer, you know? And I have my little 110-pound arm hanging out the door, you know, and I'd press that on the door to make it look big so you don't mess with me, you know? I loved it. I loved it. Everything in my, every ounce of alcohol I was taking was working, man, because it took me away from me, and it brought me into this magical place that only alcohol could take me to. And that was the most magnificent thing in my life, was the effect that it produced in me. It made me okay being me. And I've never been happy about being me. I've been a man hiding behind images my entire life, man. If it ain't the little wino over there, or the lowrider, or the little hoodlum, we always have something to hide behind. And if we don't have an image, we always have our ace in the hole, and that's our hostility. That'll keep them at bay. Anything but to let them in. Anything to let somebody in and find out how weak and afraid you really are, and how you really don't know anything about being a man. One of the startling discoveries about my sobriety when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous is that you had a 30-year-old man with a 10-year-old head. I knew nothing about being a man. Oh, I had some ideas and some images about what I thought a man was. It had nothing to do with character. It had to do with rights. It had to do with things that you survive on the streets. It had nothing to do with how to treat people. Had nothing to do with that, you know. And I'm bouncing around with these guys, and around 1969, a lot of them start going to Vietnam, and some of them start turning hippie and going to San Francisco. Me and my buddy went out to Detroit to find my roots. We wound up in Phoenix. We're over there off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel. And the Apache Hotel is about five floors up. You know, everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby. Everybody's got a bathroom, and it's down the hall. It's about $40 a month. You have a little Murphy bed. You fold it down. You got a hot plate on this side and a window on this side. And you look out that window, and you drink, and you dream, and you die. And, you know, one of these days, it ain't going to be like that. One of these days, I'm going to be having a little job and stuff like that, and everything's going to be all right. But you cap the seal off of that Thunderbird, and you go into Never Never Land one more time. I get myself a little job, and I start working for this plumber, and I fake a knee injury because I find out the guy's working younger than me, and I hook up with these guys down in Phoenix, and I start writing and selling prescriptions for barbiturates. They finally caught up with me, and when you're on wine and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase like they had, you know. And there he goes down the 10 freeway. Ain't they not? Just a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, there he is under there, you know what I mean? So they convicted me and put me away for a little while in southern Arizona, and they gave me a $45 voucher after a period of time to come back to L.A. City Hall. I come back to L.A. City Hall in 1974, and I register with probation department down there, and they give me a voucher for a hotel in downtown Torrance. And they put me on Anabuse, and I'm on Anabuse for about 2 months, and I run out of Anabuse, and I run into my little sister. I never knew that I have two sisters, an older one and a younger one. I had no idea that she loved me. I had no idea that she admired me. And I wanted anything to get into her graces again. Because I'm not drinking and I'm trying to do well and stuff like that. And she says, I need you to do me a favor. And I said, Debbie, anything you want. She says, I need you to watch the house. She says, me and my husband got to go to Monterey, California for a job in a house up there. And we can't bring the dog. And we want you to watch the house from Friday to Monday. And the only thing you have to do is walk the dog and take in the mail. And I says, don't you worry about a thing. She says, everything you want is in this house. She says, just bring in the mail and watch the dog. And I said, honey, don't worry about it. Everything's good now. You know, I've got 2 months and everything's okay. And I hadn't been on Anabuse for a couple of weeks, but I'm feeling okay. I got a little job to do. She takes off. Friday, I walk the hell out of that dog. Saturday morning, walk that dog, read her mail, you know, get the newspaper. And I see that Muhammad Ali is fighting that night. And there's nothing like an Ali fight. And I was watching Ali, but I'm used to watching Ali fight with a quart of wine. But I know I can't do that. And then the thought said, well, and then it just enters in, and it starts like a piston in an engine, and it won't leave me alone. And I think, well, I don't have no money. I can't do that, you know. And I start breaking up her house. I start going through drawers. I find a big Sparklets bottle with some pennies in there. I start shaking that thing out till I get $1.29. I shake a little bit out for some Jiffy Pop. I go down to Hans Market. I get myself a quart of wine. I come back. I turn the TV set on. I walk that damn dog again, feed him, cap the seal, and I don't remember anything till Monday morning. Monday morning, her husband's dragging me out of the house, and over every bump and step, I'm hearing my head hit the wall. I'm going by a TV, and it's busted. I'm going by a couch, and it's slid open. I'm going by a picture window, and the curtain's blowing through a busted window. We go by a gate, and the dog is gone. We go by my little sister, and my little sister's got her hand in her head, and she's sobbing. Those real big ones that take, you know, and she can't even, and she's, and I, and he's calling me every name that I've called myself in the middle of the night. Nothing new. And I didn't want that to happen. And after I left that, I tried not to drink again. And after about 2 months of back on Anabuse, they find me in a Little League dugout over there in El Segundo, California, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, stone cold sober, in between hysterical and maniacal. Not a drop in me. I'm in a place I've never been mentally and emotionally. And the paramedics come and they see that I've been attempting some type of suicide. And they send me down to the Harbor General Hospital where they diagnose that some of my overdoses have been suicide attempts, and they look at my jacket and they seem to think I need to go to a state hospital to be observed for 30 days. They send me out to a state hospital over there off of Oxnard by Camarillo, and I'm in there, and they keep me there for a year. And I come out of there totally observed, and they gave me my antipsychotics and my antidepressants, and they told me that you'll never be able to survive in society unless you take these things. And I bought the deal. And after 2 months, I'm in downtown Los Angeles, and I ran out of Thorazine, and they found me at Alvaro Street over by the Chevron gas station, curled up in a corner, a public drunk, a public nuisance. And he's in a little corner of a doorway, and he's in the fetal position, and he's crying like a baby and shaking. And they send me up to the wayside, and they put me up there for 40 days, and they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus, and they take me down to the South Bay Courthouse where I'm going to be tried and convicted. And I'm in a holding tank about half this size. And there's nothing but me and bologna sandwiches, and I'm sitting on a concrete floor. I got a Vons bag and no hope, and the only thought I have is, where are they going to send me now? And all I'm praying for is maybe I can hear some keys coming down. That's all I'm listening for, some keys. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they slid open that jail door, and a Scottish man with a patch is standing there, and he says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Well, why don't you come with me, son? You're going to AA." I said, "AA?" I said, "I've never heard of those initials before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's an AA, you know?" And I thought, you know, and who's this pirate? You know, is this a hallucination or something like that, you know? Now, the funny thing about that guy, the most miraculous thing about that man is he had no business being there. Alex had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a part of the probation department. He wasn't a part of an H&I panel. Alex had just received the worst news of his life, that his dear wife of 25 years was dying quickly of a terminal disease. And he knew she was in a good place, and he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, in his book studies, in his little step studies that he didn't want to go, in his little sponsoring people that he didn't want to sit with, he grabbed a hold of the first paragraph of Working with Others, and he bought it. That practical experience ensures us that nothing will immune us from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. That this works when other activities failed. And he knew he needed one. And he went down to that courthouse and he talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they say, "We got a guy in the holding tank that may be interested." And they sent him down there to me. And in 1975, this little Scottish pirate threw me into a 54 Chevy, and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for 15 minutes, he was your biggest cheerleader. And for 15 minutes, he could have killed me. You know how he could have killed me? He could have talked that jailhouse nonsense and that street corner nonsense so that I would feel a part of. See, he didn't talk my language to make me feel. He didn't yo mama me and yo daddy me. He made sure that he was an example in that car, and that if I wanted anything that this thing had to offer, that I would be having to copy him. And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And within that 15-minute car ride, he told me the best news I ever heard. And the earmark of the alcoholic, whether they're drunk or sober, you folks know, is that we're always able to feel different. We've always been able to feel, even in AA, we always have that thing about us that makes us feel different. And he sat me down in that car and he says, "I know you've had a hell of a life, son, but I want to tell you something." And he says, "I know you feel different." He says, "But Larry," he says, "in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are." He says, "People don't come here happy and well-adjusted, son." And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. We drove up to this Alano Club over there in Torrance. And he introduced me to these people named... a little lady named Indian Jeannie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singin' Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt. And, you know, I said, "My God, I just met a bunch of people like this, you know. A little moose come running after me like a toilet paper commercial. Hi, honey, my name is Moose and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are, man." I said, "I'm not it, you know." And then this big transvestite come out of the card room. He started circling me like a helicopter, you know, and after about 3 laps, he landed, you know. And he said, "You know, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so, you know. Not for my first year anyway, for Christ's sake, you know. I've got my pride, you know." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk, 90 days and get drunk, and the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I'm on heroin. And that don't make me a worse alkie or a better member. All that did is prove to me one thing, that I was buying the biggest lie that I've ever told myself, and that I was coming in and out of AA. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. I never once found out what an alcoholic was. I never once found out what these steps are all about. I never once weathered the storm. I didn't know that the natural state of an alcoholic when he's not drinking is restless, irritable, discontented, and 99% of the time lethally depressed. I didn't know that. I thought you'd come to AA and everything's wonderful. I see these guys with these ties on, man, get up to the podium. 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. You know, I just... You know, I came in with that guy, you know what I mean? All that did is prove to me one thing, newcomer, that if I don't change, my sobriety date will, and I don't have the power to change. Now, where are you going to get a power like that? You're powerless. My problem wasn't admitting that I was an alcoholic. My problem was conceding to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and that I was powerless over the situation. And for years, I thought that means that I'm an alcoholic. I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic. I shouldn't drink. What I bought that day was that I was an alcoholic. You know what that means to my innermost self? On May 2nd, 1982, I suffer from alcoholism. And man, I'm going to drink. I am flat going to drink. I am 23 years sober and it ain't enough. There just isn't a getting off place. And there is nothing to keep the alcoholic from drinking. There is not a living condition in the world, rich or poor, that will keep you from drinking. Because if you're an alcoholic, you are destined to drink. And the only thing that will keep you from drinking is sitting around these people you don't like, practicing these steps that you don't want to do, and doing the uncomfortable to get comfortable, and something happens to you. The miraculous thing happens to you. And I had no idea that was going on in my life. Had no idea. In 1980, all these guys are doing their 12-step work, and I'm up at the Don Hotel. I've got a hot plate and a hot tea, hot TV. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot, you know? You know, I got my little lawn chair, you know, at 10 o'clock in the morning. I got my PM bourbon bottle cut in half, and I hear this, Larry, it's Don. My God, it's a guy from AA. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here, you know? And he come in, he says, oh, my God, kid, you had 15 days. You're going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you new guys, you know? And I says, what do you want, Don? He says, well, let's get up and, you know, he never asked me, you know, are you done yet? You know? He says, my God, you had 15 days, kid. You had 15 days. And I immediately barked at that guy. Look, you've been trying real hard, but I want you to remember one thing, Don. I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know where to go. Now, why don't you get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic my entire life, let me do what I want to do. There'll be a cold day in hell before I get a man a cup of coffee in an AA meeting. It'll be a cold day in hell before I come here early and set up and put up a chair and make a pot of coffee. It'll be a cold day in hell. And if you knew, I'm praying for that cold day in hell to happen to you. I'm praying for that day. See, for a long, long time, Alcoholics Anonymous was a step down. It was a long arm of the Salvation Army. It was a long arm of some other thing. But the miraculous thing about that last drunk on May 2nd, 1982, that it wasn't my longest drunk and it wasn't my worst drunk, but it was a drunk that drank away the debate. And all of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous looked like a step up. All of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous looked like the thing for me to do. Because I knew I was destined to drink again. I knew that just not drinking was not going to be the answer. I knew I had to be in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew any minute now I was able to drink. Now, that man that 12-stepped me, that man with this patch, his sponsor had 46 years. As we speak this morning, he is up in a Portland detox with 7 weeks, crying his eyes out because for a long time he used to be in heaven. And he's wondering what the hell happened. And Alex asked him, he says, my God, Hap, what happened? He says, you had so many years. And Hap says, you bet I did. I had a lot of years, but I didn't have any days. It's the days that get you the years. We have a daily reprieve. I can't stay sober on last year's actions. I've got a daily reprieve. And I had no idea. And the only answer I had in my life left that room, that bald-headed carpenter. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you. And I can't stay drunk and I can't stay sober. And I keep winding up in that hideous spot where you're in between. And there's no middle-of-the-road answer here. I've spent my entire life looking for that middle-of-the-road answer. There's got to be another answer. I can't believe that I've got to live a spiritual way of life or be doomed to an alcoholic death. There's got to be a middle-road answer, and I'm going to find it. I'm destined to find it, and that's where we kill ourselves, looking for that middle-of-the-road answer, and we can't stay sober, and we can't stay drunk, and we're wondering what the hell's going on with us, and we become restless and irritable, and we suck on guns, we throw ourselves in front of the buses, because we don't know what the hell's going on with us, man. And on May 2nd, 82, I'm walking by a Woolworth window, I got my street mud on, I got my shoes tied to my pants, I got my hair down to my shoulders, and I'm not going there to detox, I'm living down there. I'm not bottoming out. I'm getting ready to curl up one more time in a mission, and I go by a Woolworth window, and I check eyes with the thing, and the thing is 120 pounds, and he's yellow. He's got his shoes tied to his pants. He's got his Thunderbird wine bottle in his back pocket, and I stare there looking because I finally made eye contact with me. I've been dodging my own eyes for years. I've been opening up medicine chests and not looking people in the eye and not looking at windows and cars. I never wanted to look at me, and I locked eyes with myself, and I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. How come I'm always getting drunk and I'm always getting sober? How come I'm always winding up like this and there seems to be no life at all? And I did what I always did when I wound up like that. I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I call Central Office and I get Don. I said, Don, this is Larry. I'm down here at the mission. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He says, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Excuse my French. He says, why don't you get your rusty ass down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. I said, whatever happened to that love in Alcoholics Anonymous? I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me and my God to get me to you. It wasn't no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to get out of their warm houses and leave their warm families to come and talk to me about the alcoholics. It was up to me to come to you. And I'd walked the longest 10 miles of my life. And I waddled down to that Alano Club with my poopy pants and my no hope. And I pounded on that Alano Club door that I was thrown out of. And they said, what do you want, Larry? And I says, well, if it interests you, I'm looking for Don. And they said, well, he's in the coffee room, but you better make it quick. And I waddled up to Don with no hope. And I asked a man something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said these words. I don't know what to do with my life, Don. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds. And then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. And he gave me the wood. And he told me to stay at that club, that he was going to go to work. He says, I know that's foreign to you, but I got to earn a living. And he says, you stay here. And I stayed with those people. And I puked it out. And I shook it out. And I hallucinated for 3 months. And I shook for 3 months. And I heard music for 3 months. And these people, all he would tell me to do is every night you walk to that mission. You get here at the morning meeting. And you help set up the meeting. Then you go look for work. And if you don't find work, you stay here. And that man stayed with me that whole day. And at Thursday night, the meeting was starting, and they hoisted me up by my arm. And I said, I'm Larry Thomas. I'm an alcoholic. And for the first time in my life, I felt like a member. I was no longer a guest. And for the first time in my life, I made the biggest surrender that I ever made. And that was, I don't care what that bald-headed carpenter says, does, or feels. I'm going to do whatever he says. I am tired of running my own life. I know I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to let this guy run my life. I am an example of 30 years of running my life, and the best I can do is curl up in somebody's glove compartment, shaking like a wolf. I'm going to let this guy have me, and I made the biggest surrender of my life, and that is surrendering myself to an ethic called sponsorship. And that man was my sponsor for it. He took me home that night. He took me and says, you're coming home with me, Larry. And I said, all right, man, this thing's working already, you know. I'm smelling waffles and stuff like that already, you know. And he took me into his house, you know, and he says, all right, kid, he says, get out there. And he says, you're going to sleep in that car. And he had an abandoned Toyota on blocks. He says, get into that car. And I says, take me back to the mission, you know. He says, no, you get into that car, and you're going to stay there all night. And if you sneak out, I'm going to find the cops. And he shut the door. I says, my God, whatever happened to this guy? And then he comes back in, he opens the door, and he says, and you better find a God, hot shot. And he closed the door again. I said, what is with this guy, man? I'm in a Toyota. Where am I going to find a God, you know? Is he in the glove box, in the visor, or something like that? And at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm hallucinating again, and I'm watching the trees breathe, and it finally came to me. You know what? I don't want to be new again. I am so tired of being new, tired of new on the job, new in the neighborhood, new sober. I am going to do whatever this guy tells me, not to be new again. I am just so tired of being new. And today, the core of my life is not being new. The core of my life is consistency. When I feel like leaving that woman, I treat her like we're on our first date. When I feel like storming out on that job, I feel like my first day again. I talk myself out of leaving, whatever it is. I got to talk myself into staying. I got to make contact with this staying power in Alcoholics Anonymous. This consistency in Alcoholics Anonymous that's not talked anymore. There's a beautiful principle in Alcoholics Anonymous called consistency. And consistency is where I found my God and my faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because anybody can come here when they're happy and they got a fat wallet. But when you're coming here and everything in your life is going south, and you got your life coming out your sleeve, and everything in your life is just going bad, and you have every reason, and there's death, and you're still showing up anyway, I love you. I love you for being here when everything in your life is just south. I love you for being here. See, for me, that's faith. Faith is more than being on your knees and mumbling. Faith is an action word in Alcoholics Anonymous. Gratitude's an action. What you are speaks so loud I can hardly see you. That's what my sponsor told me. And I watch you people like a hawk. I watch you like a hawk. And on May 2nd, 1982 is my first day of sobriety. And I left that sponsor after a year and a half because I started becoming somebody in my own mind. And I started holding secrets. And I started judging my sponsor. Isn't that amazing? How after you're sober a while, how imperfect they become. And the moment you spot that imperfection, well, I just think I'm going to move on here and find some perfect people to take care of my perfect ass. You know what I mean? And one of the beautiful things about steps 6 and 7 is living with your imperfect rear. That you're never going to be perfect. That the only perfect thing is the almighty spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're just a broken spoke in the wheel, baby. And you better come to these meetings with these other broken spokes so you don't feel so different. You see? I don't leave every day thinking I'm going to have a perfect day. I get on my knees and I do my reading and I leave that house knowing perfectly well I'm going to screw up. And I allow myself the privilege of being an imperfect human being, because that's the highest I'm going to get, is sober human being. And I allow myself that privilege. I know I'm going to screw up, but I got an answer today. You see? And at 2 years, I'm sitting in this club and I'm sneaking, sucking on the gun and wondering if I should run out in front of a bus. And I'm 2 years sober and I've got the AA mask on. Or hour and a half, I'm wonderful. And I go home and I, you know, take off the AA face and I die. And I wonder how I'm going to kill myself. And at 2 years sober, a man came down and he told me what I was. He said, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, Larry, called Unity, Service, and Recovery. I hope you find it, kid. And I followed that man. I followed that man to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I become part of a home group. A home group. I never was a part of a home group. My home group was these people in here. I never knew once what it's like to have brothers and sisters in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Have a sponsor to guide you and have brothers and sisters to get sober with. Nothing like having a peer group. If you're new, there's nothing more saddening than to see you struggling to stay sober and hang around your old chums. You see, in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, why don't you grab somebody to get sober with? Because when they're feeling crappy, they can pull you along. When you're feeling crappy, they can pull you along. When they're feeling crappy, you can pull them along. But at least you're pulling each other to the same place. Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Unity in Alcoholics Anonymous isn't how many people we can pack into a room. That's chaos. Unity in Alcoholics Anonymous is bringing them to a room that everybody's speaking the same thing. There's a singleness of purpose. So no matter who that guy's talking to, he's getting the same answer. He, boom, sponsorship and steps, boom, sponsorship and commitments, boom, sponsorship and steps. He's got to leave if he wants a different answer. He's blinded by the same answer. And that's what we need in a singleness of purpose. We don't need to give a guy a bunch of different crap to do. He comes in here with 30 things anyway. But if he keeps hearing the same answer, he's blinded by you. You see, and that's what I need. I didn't need a bunch of options. I needed one answer and proof that it was working. How do you know that there's a God, Larry? How do you know that there's a God in your life? You don't come from nothing. You have no religious background. Every Monday and Wednesday and Thursday, I'm sitting in the evidence. Every Monday and Wednesday and Thursday, I'm sitting in the evidence of a power. I don't got to find him. I hang around the evidence. Row after row of people who should be committing suicide and be locked up and should be dead are sitting in these meetings with 40, 30, 20, 2 years, 2 days. The evidence is here. I don't need to see the guy hanging from the cross or the skies open up. I'm going to hang around his evidence. I'm going to fall in love with his evidence. I'm going to serve his evidence. Because when I'm serving the evidence, the power is blinding. And that's all I need to have here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is just that little notion. Just that little, that flimsy reed of hope that there's a power. And I see it in you guys all the time. And my home group is where I found that. My home group is where I found my God. My home group, I'm just a coffee maker in a home. I'm just a little guy in that meeting, man. I come there and I make coffee for 22 years. That's all I do. I'm a cookie lady. And in that home group, I get to recreate that atmosphere. I get to keep that thing going so that when that guy comes in and he's restless and he's alone, or that girl comes in, that he comes into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and they're laughing and they're scratching and they're farting. He's like, man, I could do it here. I could do it here, man. These people make it look good. And I get to recreate that atmosphere that was created for me, that was created for you, that was created for Don, for Dick, for Debbie, for Lyle, for all these people. My great privilege is to be a small part of that recreation. That's all I need to be. That's all. I don't need to be no big shot. I mean to be a regular member of AA and be part of the evidence. I'm not the evidence. I'm just a part of it. And that's where I'm seen, and that's where I'm heard, and that's where His work can be done through us. Isn't that a neat deal? You ain't going to find that in bourbon. You're not going to find that in whiskey. You find it in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where there's a singleness of purpose. For a long time, these were your meetings. For a long time, I come here. These were your meetings. And I got sober with you. And I had a sponsor, and I did a fifth step, and they become my meetings, goddammit. And then after 10 years sober, you start giving me some traditions, and they become our meetings. Our meetings, our common welfare, our group conscience, our Father God, our primary purpose, our great privilege to be here in Cleveland. Yeah. I ain't going to get that anywhere else, man. What are you going to do with a guy like me? I don't know nothing. I come from nothing. Alcoholics Anonymous made me a plumber. They took me right out of the gutter and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sakes, you know. And I worked those steps with my sponsor. And I made amends to that beautiful lady. You know who I'm dating? I'm cheating on my wife right now. And you know who I'm cheating on her with? My mom. I can't stand it when these guys go, yeah, I'm going to be with my mom this weekend. I guess I'm going to be a service to my mom. Why don't you be more mechanical about it? Why don't you just go there and be your loving son? Be a service to your mom, for Christ's sake, like she's a piece of machinery. Why don't you go home and be your father's son? Why don't you go treat that lady like a mother and take the worry out of her little face? See what she needs to have done today. Oh, Scotty was talking about having that diverticulitis thing like that. My mom had that last year, and I got scared to death. I went to my sponsor, and he said, man, you better go reassure her. She needs you now, son. And I didn't know what to say with her, so I lied. You know, I said, Mom, I said, this is being done with ease. It's just like having your tonsils out, Mom. It's going to be all right. And she went into operation, and the next day it went south, and they found all kinds of stuff in there. It really went south. And I go up to there with my little $7 tulip, going to go see my mom. And the nurses say, oh, are you her son? I said, yeah. She goes, she wants to talk to you. And I waddle into my mom. My mom's laid out. She's got the hoses on. She's got all the machinery going on. And she lifts up her finger, and she goes like this. She goes, tonsils my ass. I want to tell you about being in Alcoholics Anonymous and being safe with the women here. On my way over there, I talked to my wife, my beautiful wife, Rosie. And she says, you know, why don't you just go over there and hold her hand? Women love to be massaged. And as I'm going over there, I get into the gift shop, and I get myself a little jar of lanolin hand cream, made sure it smelled like a flower. And I went up to that hospital bed, and I looked at my mom standing there, and every ounce of hard work she've ever had, every little job she had for us, every house she cleaned was running through my mind. And I thought, Mom, how would you like your feet massaged? And her feet jumped out like that, you know. And the old macho lowrider, the old loser, dipped into that jar, and I started massaging my mom's feet. And it shot me back to where I'm feeling that Cornhuskers lotion when she used to massage me. And she oohed and she awed. She loved it. And I went up there and I massaged my mom's feet. And we cried like kids. She's not afraid of me anymore. That old man that I couldn't stand, that I was fighting. See, the macho guy went after we would be drinking all night and you guys would go dancing. You know where the big player went? You know where the big macho lowrider went dancing to? I would find these old bars where people twice my age were hanging out. And I'd saddle up to a lady that reminded me of my mom. I talked to her about things I wish I could talk to my mom about. I'd saddle up to these guys that were my dad's age, and I'd talk about the Navy and the Detroit Lions and stuff like that, because I couldn't talk to my own folks, because I was so ashamed. But I made amends to that guy called my father, and I watched him pass away right in front of me with his little cancer. But we went away laughing. We went away being the best of friends, and that little 90-pound refinery worker finally put his little arms around me and says, I love you, boy. And I wonder what I was going to do when the old man passed, because we were so afraid. And I know he used to love Bobby Darin. He loved Bobby Darin so well and Nat King Cole. And every Thursday, I'd go see my daddy, and we'd go have a bowl of chili. And I didn't know what to do with that void. And so one Thursday night, my sponsor calls me. He says, what are you doing, kid? I says, well, I'm getting ready for a 12-12. He says, why don't you come on over? Let's go have some chili. And I put that old man in my car. That old man, my sponsor. We're driving around, and before you know it, he slipped in a tape and macked a knife. And every Thursday night, me and that sponsor, that hard-hearted sponsor, we go have chili, and we play Mac the Knife, and we come and be with the evidence. We come and sit in the evidence. This little girl I wasn't supposed to see, this little girl, because the macho man at 10 years sober can't hold a job because he's busy being right. You know how you're right? You know how men become right in Alcoholics Anonymous? They don't pay their child support. They get divorces, and they don't pay the alimony. And then when they go visit their little girl because they have a right because she's my blood, the two-year-old hops up into their arms and she's got holes in her underwear and holes in her socks. And that's your fault. You know why? Because you're being right. You know why? Because that first wife isn't going to get a dollar. And you know how you stay right? Is you stay poor and that little girl suffers. But that first wife ain't getting a dollar and your little daughter's paying for it. And at 10 years sober, she hopped up in my arms, and that little Cuban girl looked at me, and she said, Daddy, if you love me, why do you dress me this way? Macho Man didn't have an answer for her little crying eyes, but yet he did. It's called honesty. I don't live by rights today. I live by principles from Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat down with my sponsor and my beautiful grand sponsor over there in his mission, and I sat down, and me and the guy in that mission talked, and he says, this is what I want you to do. And I did those things. I'm proud to say from that moment to this moment, I've never had to look for a job. I've had the same job. And 4 months ago, I'm sitting in a high school stadium, and they call out Lauren Thomas. And the most beautiful woman came walking by me in a high school gown. The most beautiful lady I've ever seen in my life. And she's walking by me, and everything in me wanted to jump up and say, Lauren, I love you. And she got closer, and I'm going to do it. And I went to hop up, and this jackass stood up right next to me. He hit me with the chain to his wallet. He had all these spikes in him. He looked like a voodoo doll, you know. And he goes, Lauren, I love you. And it's her jackass boyfriend sitting there right next to me. And I love him. I love him today. What a beautiful thing. That little girl is doing so well. She says, Daddy, the kids are making fun of me in school because I'm so smart. She said, did that ever happen to you? I said, you bet, you know. You bet. What a beautiful life. That lady that I was telling you about, my wife, Rosie, we're going to have 9 years of marriage in May. I met her in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know she loves me because she doesn't need me for nothing. And she still likes to hang around me. More important, you know why I know I love her? She's the first woman that I tell other women about. She's the first woman that's not a secret. She's the first woman that there isn't need to have anybody in the bay just in case. She's the one that I want to put a smile on. And she's the one that when I look at her and I see her brown eyes, I don't ever want disloyalty to fog them up, you see. I want that thing that me and her have nurtured. And she's a busy lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. I met her 8 years ago. I spoke at a meeting in Downey, and I locked eyes with this Nicaraguan lady, and I couldn't take my eyes off her. And so after the meeting, I had to talk to her. And we started talking, and she says, do you love to backpack? I says, I love it. You know, I haven't camped my entire life. I'm thinking, you know, I spent enough time outside, thank you, you know. She goes, well, you know, we backpack every month. She says, why don't you call me tomorrow? I says, you got it. And I figured, you know, anything to get into the tent. You know, I called that lady every day since. And we got married in Alcoholics Anonymous convention one day while I was speaking in Laughlin. And after the, before the talk, my guys were there. My sponsor gave me away gladly. You take the son of a bitch, you know. My dad was there. All the guys that I sponsored were there. Her family was there from Nicaragua. They were all in a light peach color. And my little daughter was a flower girl. And she came around that bend, and they started playing that song, and I broke down, and I started crying. My sponsor started crying. My baby started crying. Her family's laughing their ass off, and they call it Alcoholics Anonymous, man, you know. And we've got a beautiful life together. I love that lady Rosie, and I hope one of these days I work hard enough, or maybe one of these days I can save enough money, maybe go to Nicaragua, have that lady take me to the hut that she was born in, so that I can kneel down and kiss the very ground she was walked on and made her first steps. And that's what it's like going to Dr. Bob's house. That's what I owe to Dr. Bob's house. That's what I owe to this man right here and the legacies that are before us. This program was created by somebody's life and blood. It just didn't come out of a pamphlet that they have at the carry unit. This is the only answer we have for alcoholics of our type. And it's only up to the alcoholics to take care of it. So if you're new and you feel like you're in your final hour, don't you be afraid. If it feels like we're boring and glum here, don't you worry. There's an old story about this young kid watching the old man in the lighthouse, and he watched him because the old man lived by himself in the lighthouse. And he finally waddled up to that old man, and he says, I bet you're lonely in here. And that old man in the lighthouse said, son, not since I've saved my first life. Not since I started sponsoring people and become part of this answer did my life start to flourish, and I haven't been ever lonely again. I am surrounded by the evidence of an almighty power. And all you want me to do is come and do some simple little things. So if you're new and you feel like you're in your final hour, I have a hunch from where I stand with my good friend like Don, I think you're in your finest hour. Thank you.